sent a ransom demand and raped and killed her even as your parents were struggling to raise the money. Very ingenious of him, you have to admit. I mean, there he was, coming up with ways to get paid for his work. God damn it! Melanie had had enough. I am not Russell Lee Holmes's daughter. You, on the other hand, are a crackpot. Goodbye. Melanie took a step. Larry Digger snapped his hand around her wrist and held tight. For the first time, Melanie was afraid. When she turned, however, the reporter said calmly, "Of course you're Russell Lee's daughter. Let go of my arm. You were found the night Russell Lee Holmes died," the reporter continued as if she hadn't spoken. "They ever tell you that?" "Yep. Russell Lee goes to the chair in Texas and a little girl without a past suddenly appears in Harper Stokes' hospital. Awfully coincidental if you ask me. And then you gotta wonder, why was Harper even working that night? The man who killed his little girl is being executed and he stays home to work? Kind of strange if you ask me. Unless he knows he has a good reason to stick around the hospital."
"I was drugged and abandoned in the ER," Melanie said slowly. "My father is a cardiac surgeon. That he came downstairs at all was purely a fluke."
"Or good timing."
"Oh, for heaven's sake! How many men die a day in the U.S. anyway? A few thousand? A few hundred thousand? Want to tell me I'm their daughter, too?"
She gave the reporter an exasperated glance and simultaneously yanked her arm free. Digger appeared unconcerned, fishing out a rumpled pack of cigarettes and pounding out a smoke.
"Come on, Miss Holmes. You honestly never wondered where you came from? You're not the teeniest bit curious."
"Goodbye."
He smiled.
"I know your family, Melanie. Your mom, your dad, your brother. I covered their story when Megan was kidnapped, and I was with Patricia and Brian the night they fried Russell Lee Holmes. You don't want to listen to me, fine. You go inside and tell your mother that Larry Digger is here to see her. Didn't she just get out of rehab? I understand that since the death of her first daughter, her nerves have never been the same."
Digger exhaled a plume of smoke right into Melanie's face.
"What do you think?"
"You are a piece of shit."
"Ah, honey, I've been called worse."
Digger flicked ash off the end of his cigarette.
"How's Brian, anyway? I remember him pressing his face to the glass in the witness room. You know, back then, when they fried Russell Lee, it was gruesome. Just plain sick. Everyone closed their eyes and covered their ears. But 14-year-old Brian Stokes pressed his face against the glass and stared at Russell Lee dying as if he was trying to sear it into his brain. Sear it, mind you. I hear Brian's gay now. You think watching a man die could affect a man's sexual preferences? Just asking."
The last comment, so cruel in its casualness, struck Melanie like a blow. She had to close her eyes, and then she was so angry she couldn't speak. She wanted to hurt him. The intensity of the desire balled her hands into fists. But she was no match for him, fat and all, and they both knew it.
"I want you away from my family," she said finally. "Whatever it is you have to say, you say it here. If you honestly have a story, I'm sure a quote from a killer's child is worth enough to you to stay the hell away from them. Deal?"
Larry Digger pretended to consider it. He took another deep drag from his cigarette and looked at the park around them, but his beady eyes were already gleaming triumphantly.
"I like you," Digger said suddenly. "I don't like most people, Miss Holmes, but I like you. You not only have Russell Lee's eyes, you got his spine."
"I'm just so darn flattered," Melanie spat out, and Digger laughed.
"Yeah. You're a fine piece of work. So tell me, sweetheart, what's it like to suddenly get to live with so much money?"
"Oh, it's just as good as you dreamed, Larry, and everything you'll never have."
"Yeah? Too bad I'm going to ruin it for you."
Larry Digger stubbed out a cigarette on the tree trunk and got serious.
"The hospital?"
he said.
"I think that's the key. Over 100 hospitals in this city, and you just happen to end up at Harper's.
Coincidence."
"Maybe. But they all start to add up after a while. First, we got the timing, Miss Holmes. You just happened to appear the night Russell Lee is fried for killing little kids. Then we got location. You just happened to be dropped at Harper's Hospital, and he just happened to have blown off an execution to be there. Then we got you. A little girl. Found perfectly clothed and in good health, but nobody ever claimed you. All these years, not a single whisper from the people who must have taken care of you for 9 years, bought you clothes, fed you, put a roof over your head. Hell, even made sure you were found at a hospital, where you'd be in good hands. And then there's the matter of your amnesia. A healthy little girl who couldn't remember anything about where she came from, not even her own name. And all these years later, 2 decades later, you still don't remember. Seems strange to me that a 9-year-old child could appear out of nowhere, remember nothing, and be claimed by no one. Strange. Or planned.
You know what they say? Truth is stranger than fiction.
Oh, that's a good one, Miss Holmes. Harper ever take you to a hypnotist? What about regression therapy or aromatherapy or whatever else quacks are dreaming up these days?
The doctors who checked me out said I was physically fine and that I'd remember when I was ready to remember.
Come on, Miss Holmes. Surely the great Dr. Harper Stokes had a few opinions on this subject. He could have taken you to a hypnotist any time, and what would anybody have done about it? What would have happened? You would have remembered. That's what. And your family, sweetheart, doesn't want you to remember.
Oh, this is stupid. All you have supplied are a bunch of coincidences, and your little scenario has holes you could drive a truck through. Plain and simple, my parents loved Megan. No way would they knowingly have adopted the child of her killer. That doesn't make sense. Larry Digger was looking at her curiously.
You honestly believe that, don't you?
Of course I do. What the hell do you mean?
Huh.
He nodded to himself as if she'd just answered a very important question. Melanie shook her head, starting to feel more confused now, as if she were at the top of a very steep precipice and she'd just taken her first misstep. The throbbing in her head was growing. Black voids were appearing in front of her eyes. She hadn't suffered from a serious migraine in years, but now she had the faint realization that she was dangerously close to vomiting.
Maybe you had to know Harper and Patricia in Texas,
Digger was murmuring.
Maybe you had to see them sitting up in their rich palace no fourth-year resident should be able to afford. Maybe you had to see them in Texas with their 2 kids. One so sweet, everyone loved her, and one already so troubled. Half the moms on the block wouldn't let him play with their children. I'm getting the impression, Miss Holmes, there's a hell of a lot about your family you just plain don't know.
That's not true. It's not.
Ah, Miss Holmes.
Larry Digger sounded sympathetic, almost pitying. It confused her more than his vicious comments had.
Let me tell you something, Melanie. For your own sake. I didn't find you on my own, kid. I got a tip. An anonymous call in the middle of the night. Needless to say, reporters don't like anonymous tips. Not even washed-up pieces of shit like me.
His teeth flashed, then his voice turned horribly somber.
I had the caller traced the second time, Miss Holmes. Right back to Boston, Massachusetts. Right back to Beacon Street. Right back to your house. Why do you think that is, Mel? Why is someone from your house calling me about Russell Lee Holmes?
I don't... It doesn't... None of this makes any sense. The world tilted suddenly. Melanie sat down on the ground. She heard herself whisper.
But that was so long ago.
Larry Digger smiled.
You get what you deserve, Melanie Stokes. By the caller's own words, you get what you deserve.
No.
How much of a person's temperament is genetic, Melanie Holmes? Are junkyard dogs born or raised? Are you really as polished and refined as your uptight adoptive parents? Or does a little Texas white trash lurk beneath that surface? I already know you can be tough. Now, what about violence? Ever look at a little kid, Miss Holmes, and feel hungry?
No. No, oh God.
Her head exploded. Melanie grabbed her temples, pressed her forehead against her knees, and rocked on the grass. From far away, she heard Larry Digger chortle.
I'm right, aren't I? 25 years later, I'm finally getting it right.
His words suddenly ended in a yelp. Melanie turned slowly. A white figure had joined them in the park. He seemed to have his hand clamped on Larry Digger's shoulder.
She asked you to leave,
the newcomer said calmly. Larry Digger tried to push the man away.
Hey, this is private. Don't you got hors d'oeuvres to serve or something?
No, but I'm thinking of sharpening my knives.
The man tightened his grip even more, and Digger held up his hands in surrender. The minute he was released, he backed up.
Okay, I'll go. But I'm not lying. I do have proof, Miss Holmes. I have information not just about your father, but your birth mother as well. Ever think of her, Miss Holmes? Bet she could actually tell you your real birthday, let alone your real name. Midtown Hotel, sweetheart. Pleasant dreams.
The man took a quick step forward at the sarcastic tone, and Larry Digger hightailed it out of there, his stained coat flapping behind him. Melanie's stomach heaved. She celebrated Larry Digger's departure by spewing shrimp all over the grass and the man's glossy black shoes.
Shit,
he yelped, leaping back awkwardly. He didn't seem to know what to do. That made two of them. Tears of rage streamed down Melanie's cheeks. Her head was throbbing and images added to the chaos in her mind. Blue dress, blonde hair, pleading eyes. I want to go home now. Please let me go home.
Are you going to be okay?
A hand draped back her hair.
Jesus, you're burning up. Let me call an ambulance.
No.
Melanie's fear of hospitals outweighed her fear of pain. She snapped her head up and promptly winced.
Give me a minute.
Her savior was not impressed.
Jesus, lady. You go walking with a seedy-looking stranger? What were you thinking?
Nothing, obviously.
Melanie pressed the heels of her hands against her eyes. The man was absolutely right, and she resented him for it. With no other choice, she finally risked opening her eyes. It was hard to see in the dark. The gas lamp caught the man's features only in a half wash, illuminating a square jaw, lean cheeks, and a nose that had been broken a few too many times. Thick, dark hair cut conservatively short, lips pressed into a grim, unyielding line. She recognized his uniform. Great. She'd just been saved by one of her own waiters. She closed her eyes again. Nothing like being caught at her worst by someone who could spread stories.
Are you going to live?
The waiter asked sharply.
Possibly. It would help if you'd lower your voice.
He seemed contrite for a moment, then ruined the impression with his next words.
You shouldn't have let him drag you off like that. That was a stupid thing to do. Did he want money?
Who doesn't?
Melanie staggered to her feet, needing to move, to just move. Unfortunately, the ground shifted beneath her. The trees bobbed. The waiter had to grab her arm.
You keep trying to stand, and we're going to have to start a suicide watch for you. Vision?
White dots.
Hearing?
What?
Prescription meds, right?
In the house,
she murmured, and tried to take a step. Her legs collapsed. The waiter caught her. She floated limply on his arm, suddenly beyond carrying.
Please, please let me go home.
No, honey, you don't want to go home. It's not safe. The man muttered something about foolish women, then swung her up in his arms. She leaned against his shoulder. He felt solid and firm and strong. He smelled like Old Spice. Melanie buried her face against his neck and let the world slip away. Special Agent David Riggs was not happy. First, because he wasn't fond of rescuing damsels in distress. Second, because he was going to take a lot of heat for rescuing this particular damsel.
We're eyes and ears only at this stage. This is a very delicate investigation. Don't fuck it up.
Riggs was pretty sure Supervisory Agent Lairmore would consider following, intervening, and now carrying Melanie Stokes to be a fuck-up. He was supposed to be shadowing her father. He was supposed to be overhearing Dr. Harper Stokes' confession of healthcare fraud, that he would casually drop at his daughter's black tie event, high on vodka tonics and friends. Uh-huh. David shifted Melanie more comfortably in his arms and crossed the street. She was smaller than he would have guessed, having watched her dart around the house all evening like a firefly. She never slowed down, and hardly even seemed to need a gasp of air. He'd watched her do everything from heft boxes of mangoes to mop up a spill. He'd also noted that she circled back to the living room half a dozen times to discreetly check up on her mother. Now she was leaning her head against his shoulder in a way a woman hadn't done in a long, long time. He didn't know what to make of that, so he turned his mind sharply to the file he had on the Stokes family and the few things it told him about Melanie Stokes. Daughter, adopted at the age of 9 after being abandoned at the hospital where Dr. Stokes worked. A bit of a media buzz portraying her as a modern-day orphan Annie. She'd graduated with a BA from Wellesley in 91 and was active in various charitable organizations. One of those, I want to give something back to the world kind of people. 9 months earlier, she'd become engaged to Dr. William Sheffield, her father's favorite right-hand man, then ended it a mere 3 months later without ever giving a reason. One of those, my business is my business kind of people. She helped take care of her mother, who, as Larry Digger had pointed out, had never been the same since the murder of her first daughter. One of those, you mess with my family, you mess with me kind of people. Whatever. Nothing in the files indicated that Melanie Stokes was the daughter of a serial killer, though. David had found the reporter's list of coincidences extremely interesting. Then again, David couldn't decide what he thought of the reporter. For all his bluster, Larry Digger's hands had been shaking toward the end. The man had probably skipped his nightly pint of bourbon to make contact. No doubt he was drowning in it now. Melanie moaned as the house lights hit them both.
Don't throw up on me again, David muttered.
Wait.
Are you going to be sick?
Wait. She gripped his jacket. Don't tell anyone, she muttered intently. Not my family. I'll pay you.
Her eyes were clear, big and earnest and a startling color, somewhere between blue and gray.
Yeah, well, sure. Whatever you want.
She sank back down into his arms, seemingly satisfied. David pushed into the foyer and everyone spotted them at once.
What's going on here?
Harper Stokes immediately strode toward them, William Sheffield in tow. Then Patricia Stokes came flying, sloshing orange juice on her designer dress.
Oh my God, Melanie!
Bedroom?
David asked, and ignoring everyone's gasps and questions, headed up the stairs.
She mentioned having a migraine.
Harper swore.
She should have Fioranol with codeine in the bathroom. Patricia!
She darted ahead 3 flights and burst from her daughter's bathroom, pills and water in hand, just as David laid Melanie down on a rumpled bed. Immediately, he was pushed aside by her family. Harper anxiously picking up his daughter's hand and checking her pulse. He took the water and held it to his daughter's pale lips to wash down the pills. Patricia followed with a damp towel, gently bathing Melanie's face. That left William Sheffield, who hovered self-consciously in the doorway. It wasn't clear to David why the former fiancé was even in the room.
What happened?
Harper demanded. He checked his daughter's pulse again, then took the towel from his wife and positioned it across Melanie's forehead.
Where was Melanie? How did you end up with her?
I found her in the park,
David said. Apparently the answer sounded as vague to Harper as it did to David, because the surgeon shot him a look. David returned the stare. Of all the people in the room, David knew the most about Dr. Harper Stokes. He'd spent the past 3 weeks compiling a file on the man. Considered a brilliant surgeon by many, he'd recently been anointed the top cardiac surgeon in a town known for its surgeons. Others alleged he was an egomaniac, that his zealousness to heal had more to do with the recognition it brought him than honest interest in his patients. Given the growing Hollywoodization of hospital surgery, David found that a tough call to make. Most cardiac surgeons these days were after fame or fortune. After all, there were NBA athletes courted less aggressively than a good, charismatic surgeon who could bring in the bucks. The only thing different David could find out about Dr. Harper Stokes was his background. In a day and age when a surgeon's career track started at the age of 18 with enrollment in an Ivy League college, Dr. Stokes's academic career was mediocre at best. He'd graduated from Texas A&M at the middle of his class. He hadn't gotten into any of the top 20 medical schools, having to settle for his local safety school, Sam Houston University. There, he'd been known more for his upscale wardrobe and dogged worth ethic than for a gift for surgery. Oddly enough, the single event that seemed to transform Harper Stokes from average resident to surgeon extraordinaire was the kidnapping of his daughter. His personal life had disintegrated, and he had turned to work. The more chaotic the Stokes' world became, the more time Harper spent in the hospital, where he did have the power to heal and redeem and, what the hell, play God. Russell Lee Holmes may have destroyed a family, but in a strange way, he had also created one top-notch surgeon. Recently, the FBI had received 3 phone calls on the healthcare fraud hotline about Boston's number one cardiac man. Someone thought Harper's pacemaker surgeries were questionable. At this point in the investigation, David had no idea. Could be just a jealous rival blowing smoke. Could be that the doctor had come up with a way to make a few extra bucks. God knows the Stokes has lived high enough on the hog. So far, the only dirt David had found on the man was his penchant for beautiful women. Even that didn't seem to be much of a secret. He went out with his pieces of pretty young fluff. His wife kept looking the other way. Lots of marriages worked like that.
But why was Melanie in the park?
Harper was asking with a frown, jerking David's attention back to the cramped bedroom. Melanie answered first.
I wanted some fresh air. I was going to step out for only a moment.
I happened to notice her leaving the house,
David said.
When she hadn't returned for a while, I decided to see if everything was all right. I heard the sound of someone being ill across the street and found her.
Harper remained frowning, then turned to his daughter with a mixture of genuine concern and reproach.
You've been pushing yourself too hard, Melanie. You know what stress can do to you. You have to remember to monitor your level of anxiety. For heaven's sake, your mom and I would have helped you more if you'd just said something.
I know.
You take too much upon yourself.
I know.
It's not healthy, young lady.
Melanie smiled wryly.
Would you believe I get it from you?
Harper harumphed, but appeared honestly sheepish. He glanced at his wife, and the two of them exchanged a look David couldn't read.
We should let her rest, Patricia said. Honey, you just get some sleep. Relax. Your father and I will handle everything downstairs. It's my job, Melanie tried to protest, but the pills were getting the better of her, making her eyelids droop.
She made an effort at sitting up in the bed, but didn't even make it past halfway. Finally, she curled up in a little ball in the middle of the big sleigh bed. She looked frailer than she had standing up to the reporter. She looked. Patricia covered her with a quilt, then ushered everyone out.
You just happened to notice Mel leaving the house?
William Sheffield said as David brushed by him. David calmly responded.
Yes, I did you?
The ex-fiancé flushed, glanced quickly at Harper for support, and when he got none, slunk away.
Thank you for helping our daughter, mister.
Patricia paused in the doorway long enough to place a light hand on David's shoulder.
Reese. David Reese.
Patricia kept her hand on his shoulder.
Thank you, Mr. Reese. Really, we are indebted.
Not a big deal.
She smiled, an expression that was sad.
To me, it is.
Before David had to summon another reply, Jamie O'Donnell burst up the stairs, demanding to know what had happened to his Melanie. A trim woman with graying, Brillo-like hair and nurse's whites was hot on his heels. Aunt Margaret, David heard Patricia exclaim. David used the opportunity to exit, then paused on the second-story landing to eavesdrop. O'Donnell was adamant about being informed. Aunt Margaret insisted upon seeing Melanie. Harper uttered something sharp and low under his breath. David didn't catch it, but all 4 adults immediately hushed up. No more conversations from upstairs, just the sounds of 4 adults easing into Melanie Stokes' bedroom. The hair was prickling on the back of David's neck. He hadn't felt this way in a long time. Not since that day he'd sat in the doctor's office, waiting for the final news, then saw the look on the MD's face when he walked back into the examining room. At that moment, David had known that life as he knew it, as his father knew it, was coming to an end. There was no good reason for him to feel that way here. So far, he had just a doctor, a family, and a drunken reporter. Nothing that sinister. Nothing that promising as an investigative lead. And yet, what was it Larry Digger had said? He'd received his tip on Melanie Stokes' alleged parentage from an anonymous caller who declared that everyone gets what they deserve. That was odd. 3 weeks earlier, when the Boston field office had received an anonymous tip regarding Dr. Stokes' alleged illegal surgeries, the caller had also insisted that everyone gets what they deserve. And David didn't believe in coincidences. 4. 3 a.m. David Riggs' shift as a waiter for the reception finally ended and released him into the streets of Boston. He was limping badly, his back feeling the strain even more than usual. Playing waiter was hard work. It meant he got to serve drinks, replenish hors d'oeuvre trays, and scrub his knuckles raw cleaning up. It meant he got to run all over hell and back, trying to be both a decent server and a diligent agent. Next time Larimore asked him to go undercover, Riggs would nominate Cheney. Let the rookie lead the glamorous life. Beacon Street was deserted now, the rich folks asleep in their townhouses. Farther down, however, he heard the telltale rattle of a grocery cart on city sidewalks. Not all of Boston's residents were wealthy. David kept walking, cutting across the public garden where hours earlier he'd eavesdropped on Larry Digger and Melanie Stokes. He should probably call Cheney, see how the rookie was holding up. The new kid in the Boston healthcare fraud squad was a serious bodybuilder, one of those guys who look like a giant slab of meat. Big, square head on top of a big, square neck on top of a big, square torso. When he walked, his bulging arms arced out to the side like an ape. He was hard to take seriously, particularly when he introduced himself as a former CPA. David still wasn't sure what he thought of the kid. It didn't help that Cheney had no training. The Academy gave agent wannabes only a 16-week basic intro to white-collar crime. The real plunge into the fun-filled world of MDRs, HMOs, unbundling, uploading, Part A versus Part B claims wouldn't happen until time and budget permitted Cheney to take specialized training through the National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association. Until then, it was sink or swim, the Bureau's favorite way of seeing what rookie agents were made of. Tonight, Cheney was supposed to be trailing Dr. William Sheffield, but David had caught the anesthesiologist leaving the party after 2 a.m., and Cheney hadn't been anywhere in sight. Either he was very, very good or asleep on the job. David knew where he'd cast his vote. He grimaced in pain, caught sight of an on-duty cab, and made his decision. At this stage of the investigation, nothing was moving that urgently. He and Cheney could catch up in the morning. The ride home was long, and by the end, David was curled up on the floor, his nostrils filled with the rancid odor of sweat and tobacco, while his lower back convulsed and he writhed helplessly. He stumbled out of the taxi as soon as it pulled up to his Waltham apartment complex, shoved money into the cab driver's hand, and staggered to his feet. He walked around the parking lot, had to work the muscles, had to get them to relax. Movement was important. Exercise the only way to keep what flexibility he could. Your sacroiliac joints are inflamed, Mr. Riggs. That's the joint where your spine is connected to your pelvis, and that inflammation will start to spread up your back, causing increased discomfort. Exercise, ice, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are the key.
I was an athlete. I was supposed to be a major league pitcher. I know how to ice down. I know pain.
There's not much else we can tell you, Mr. Riggs. Ankylosing spondylitis symptoms vary intensely from person to person and are systemic. You may experience fever, fatigue, and digestive problems, and sometimes AS attacks organs such as your eyes, heart, and lungs. We can't predict how it will affect you personally. All we can tell you is that arthritis is chronic, and those people who promise you a miracle cure are only trying to make a quick buck. You can still lead a full, satisfying life with AS, of course, Mr. Riggs. And there are many organizations out there to help you. But you will have to be more creative. Figure out the lifestyle that works best for you.
I have no life. I have no lifestyle. I am so damn tired.
The worst of the spasms finally passed. He kept walking anyway, though he wasn't sure why. Maybe because he'd gone so long without sleep, he'd forgotten how to do it. Maybe because he'd come to dread his bed, where he would start out in slumber and end up clutching his throat, gulping for air. He hadn't experienced that until 2 weeks ago. He didn't know if it was some kind of phase or if his arthritis had gotten worse. And he didn't ask, because he was never sure if he wanted to know the answer. He thought of baseball, the heady days of Sweet 16. Saturday afternoons, playing ball with his dad and his younger brother, Stephen, talking about the show. Because Bobby Riggs had been a pretty good pitcher in his day, made it to the minors, and now looked at his sons with hope. Then, out of the blue, Heather Riggs had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and her husband and sons had come to the field just to take a break from the pain. Then young, beautiful Heather Riggs had died from the breast cancer, and they'd come out to the field because it was all they had left. A father and his two sons whacking balls and sliding around bases, learning to communicate with each throw, hit, and catch. Cancer could take a loving mother and wife and rip a family apart. But baseball would never let you down. Baseball was as good as gold. And so was David's arm. David's arm had been the best of the best. David's arm could take him to the show. At 17, he'd been a mass all-star pitcher, and the pro team scouts were already knocking on the door. He and his dad would stay up late talking about which major league teams had the best pitching programs for him, which place they would choose. Then the nagging pain in his lower back wouldn't go away. He had problems running. Bruised tendon, they thought. Maybe he was out pitching his arm. Needed to give it a break. David had to ease up. Stephen took over for a while. But David's back got worse, and his shoulder got worse. And one day he was in a doctor's office being told his joints were too inflamed for him to continue pitching, while Stephen was throwing his first no-hitter. The Riggs men had never been quite the same since. David gave up serious baseball. Pro teams didn't recruit young studs with health problems, and went to college instead. He didn't play baseball anymore. He left that to Stephen, who did get a college scholarship but was never scouted by the pros. Stephen had an arm, but he didn't have David's arm, and they all knew it. Stephen was now an assistant baseball coach at UMass Amherst, happily married with two great kids and maybe the next major leaguer. And since David couldn't be an all-star pitcher for his father, he'd offered up federal agent instead. He'd put away murderers, catch a serial killer, get a movie of the week. When he'd been assigned to the Boston office, he'd fantasized about exposing Boston's mafia. He'd work undercover to expose the prominent crime families and have a showdown with the head don. First year out of the academy, a chiropractor finally diagnosed David as having AS. His bad back would never get better. The bureau assigned him to white-collar crime, where the biggest field danger was paper cuts from sorting through hundreds of boxes of subpoenaed files. David got good reviews each year for his analytics, the Bureau's euphemism for being adept at speed-reading large quantities of gibberish while downing takeout Chinese. And he watched his academy classmates break up drug rings, foil terrorism plots, and get promoted first. Those were the breaks in the Bureau. His back felt much better now. Did that mean it would let him sleep? Nearly 5 in the morning. Stephen probably had a game today. He should drive over and watch. His father would be there. David would probably go into work instead. The cleanup at the Stokes house wasn't finished yet, and David needed the excuse to be around. It would give him a chance to learn more about Dr. Harper Stokes and Digger's strange allegations about his adopted daughter. David walked into his apartment as the first rays of sun began to lighten the sky. Only 2 pictures decorated the walls. Fenway Park lit up at night. Shoeless Joe Jackson. Not much about the place to call home. David cast off his clothes without turning on the light and slid into bed. 2 more hours until the alarm clock would go off. He needed to sleep. He stared at the portrait of Shoeless Joe instead.
"Remind me life isn't fair," he muttered to his idol. "And tell me it's okay, damn it. It's okay."
Shoeless Joe didn't reply. After a moment, David rolled over and pretended to get some sleep. 5. At 4 a.m., Melanie bolted awake, a scream ripe in her throat and images blazing in her mind. Little Megan Stokes chasing her with a bloody head. Little Megan Stokes chanting,
Russell Lee Holmes, Russell Lee Holmes. You're just the brat of Russell Lee Holmes.
Melanie climbed out of bed. Her breathing was hard, her hands were shaking. She could taste blood. She finally realized that in her instinctive effort not to make any noise, she'd bitten her tongue. She rubbed her damp cheeks, took a deep breath. A minute more and she slid to her feet. Downstairs, she could hear the grandfather clock ticking. Other than that, the three-story house was perfectly still. Melanie moved quietly, driven by an impulse she didn't care to examine just yet. She headed downstairs. The living room was empty, the furniture reassembled, and the whole room cast in a soft glow from the gas lamps on the street. She drifted toward the fireplace, feeling lonely. Since her breakup with William, she'd had too many nights like this one, when she woke up to silence and roamed the house, looking for something she couldn't name. Until he'd proposed to her, she actually hadn't thought too much about a family of her own. She had her parents to take care of, her brother to worry about. Her life was full enough. But then William had asked for her hand in marriage. She'd never been sure why. She'd said yes. She'd never been sure why. Maybe because at that moment she had a vision of herself as Cinderella, living happily ever after with Prince Charming, and that vision had seduced her. The hard facts of reality had emerged soon enough. She didn't miss William, though. What she missed, she supposed, was the dream. She came to a halt in front of the fireplace, and her gaze turned automatically to the huge oil painting of little Megan Stokes.
First we got the timing, Miss Holmes. You just happened to appear the night Russell Lee is fried for killing little kids. Then we got location. You just happened to be dropped at Harper's Hospital, and he just happened to have blown off an execution to be there. Then we got you. A little girl. Found perfectly clothed and in good health, but nobody ever claimed you. All these years, not a single whisper from the people who must have taken care of you for 9 years, bought you clothes, fed you, put a roof over your head. Hell, even made sure you were found at a hospital, where you'd be in good hands. And then there's the matter of your amnesia. A healthy little girl who couldn't remember anything about where she came from, not even her own name. And all these years later, 2 decades later, you still don't remember.
No, she whispered to Megan. I don't remember, I swear I don't.
But she wasn't sure anymore. The stirrings in her mind, the recurring black voids, the little girl's voice. How many times now? She'd tried to pretend it wasn't happening, that her mind wasn't beginning to open up and show her things she didn't want to know. She already had a family. She didn't want to know about a serial killer, or her birth parents, or her first 9 years. None of that mattered. The only thing that did was that when she'd been abandoned in a hospital without even a name, the Stokeses had stepped in and rescued her. For God's sake, she would be nothing without the Stokeses, nothing. 20 years ago, she'd been a little girl waking up alone in a hospital ER. The white, white walls, the scary needles and tubes, the bewildering, frightening faces of strangers. Everyone assured her she would be all right. Everyone told her that her parents would show up at any time and set everything straight. She was well fed, well taken care of. Someone out there most certainly loved her. A couple of days passed. Time spent in the peds ward listening to other little children whimper and be comforted by their parents. Melanie would roll over in her high, white hospital bed and stare at the blank wall, trying desperately to picture the mommy who would come one day soon to comfort her. Social services took over, transferred her to a nearby hospice. No more talk about the return of her loving parents. Now everyone murmured about finding a good foster home instead. What about adoption? It would be one thing if she were a baby, she heard someone say. But since she wasn't. Night after night, alone in a plain room, realizing more and more that no one was going to magically arrive for her. No one was going to take her home. No one could even give her a name. Then Patricia Stokes came.
She appeared in the doorway in a pretty pink suit, saying she'd come to read Melanie a story. Melanie didn't say a word. She looked at the thin, beautiful woman with her sad, lilting voice, and had thought almost viscerally, "I want her." She'd thrown her arms around the pretty lady. She'd buried her face against her fragrant neck. "Tell me everything is all right now. Tell me I have a home." The beautiful Mrs. Stokes had read her a story about a fairy tale princess. For reasons Melanie hadn't known, she'd cried at the end. Then she'd hastily dried her tears, given Melanie a yearning look, and quickly left the room. Later, one of the social workers explained to Melanie that Mrs. Stokes had lost her 4-year-old daughter years ago in Texas. It had been very tragic. Now the Stokes were starting over in Boston, and Dr. Harper Stokes and his wife were among the most generous people in the community. Really a lovely couple. So sad what had happened, of course, but sometimes God knows best. Melanie got it. The Stokeses were missing a little girl the way she was missing a family. Apart, they were all lonely. Together, they would fit. The next time Patricia arrived, she thrust out her arms. In an instant, Mrs. Stokes folded her into her embrace. She began to cry again. This time, Melanie patted her back.
"It's all right now," she whispered solemnly. "I'll be your little girl, and everything will be all right."
Patricia had cried harder. 6 months later, the Stokeses brought Melanie home. By the time she was 12, Melanie was the only one who could make her overworked father laugh. She was the one who understood Brian and his black moods. Then there were the really dark nights, when her brother stayed out late and her father worked late, when Melanie would go downstairs and find her mother staring up at the oil portrait of the 4-year-old daughter who would never be coming home. The little girl Patricia had brought into the world and lost. The little girl who, even though Patricia had Melanie, she still couldn't forget. On those nights, Melanie would lead her mother upstairs and into bed. Then she would sit with her mother in the silence and hold her hand, trying to help her simply get through.
"It's okay, Mom. I'll take care of you. I will always take care of you."
5:00. The grandfather clock chimed again, rousing Melanie from her memories. She was still staring at Megan Stokes, who beamed as she held out her favorite red wooden horse to whoever was watching her. Little Megan, with the perfect blue ruffled dress, big blue eyes, and golden sausage curls. Bright Megan, who just 3 weeks after the painting was completed, would be dead. And 20 years later, the Stokes family was still trying to get over it. Melanie understood now that there were some wounds not even an earnest new daughter could mend. She finally turned away. She curled up on the sofa and whispered,
"But they're my family too, Megan. I earned them. I did."
The man hummed softly to himself in the dark room, making a list, checking it twice. 25 years he'd waited, thought about what he'd do. Turned it over in his mind, refined it until it was absolutely right. 3 weeks earlier, he'd started the ball rolling with a single phone call. First, get everyone in the same room. With Larry Digger's arrival just a few hours ago, the last of the players had arrived. Now let the games begin. 25 years ago, such crimes had been committed, both big and small. 25 years ago, such sins had been tolerated, both big and small. He had always thought human nature would take care of everything in the end. Someone would break. Someone would talk. Maybe even Larry Digger would finally put the pieces together. But year had passed into year, and everyone did absolutely nothing. Told nothing, asked nothing, remembered nothing, learned nothing. Everyone got away with it. He had had enough. Now he was taking matters into his own hands. Starting with the list. The complete compilation of the crimes committed by each. The crime of not telling. The crime of not knowing. The crime of not remembering. The crime of unconditional love. The crime of unrelenting cowardice. The crime of never being enough of a man. Then there came the worst crime, a crime so big he could not come up with a name that could capture its full nature. It was hypocrisy and greed and selfishness all rolled into one. It was taking what other people had simply because they had it. It was heartlessness, and it was worse. It was ruining people's lives and not losing a moment of sleep. It was the one real sin, for he had often thought that the true heart of the devil was contempt. He had not come up with the price for this sin. It needed to be special. It needed to be simple. And it needed to be horrible. He returned to what he did have. Candles and feathers and ancient art. A child's toy and a child's dress. Cow tongues and pig hearts and a bushel of apples. An object that bobbed in a glass jar and was so gruesome not even he could stand the sight. A phone number. His preparations were complete. Time for the opening gift. He studied his list. He studied his pile. He made his decision. Melanie. Melanie, who had actually found happiness as the Stokes' other daughter. Melanie, who in all these years had never done him the favor of remembering. He got out his butcher's knife. He sharpened the blade. He was ready. Do you know the perfect crime? I do. 6. Sunday was a beautiful day. Bright spring sun, gaily chirping birds. Melanie woke up to discover herself on the camelback sofa with waiter David Reese peering down at her. She sat up in a hurry.
What the hell are you doing in my living room?
My job. What the hell are you doing sleeping here?
None of your business.
Melanie blinked owlishly. It was bright. Too bright. And noisy, too. Screeching cars, shouting pedestrians, honking horns. She suddenly had a bad feeling.
What time is it?
1:30.
Oh my God!
Melanie never slept past 8. Never. And now it was all coming back to her. The scene with Larry Digger, David Reese carrying her home, the bad dream, the long night in front of Megan Stokes' portrait. And now David Reese again, still smelling like Old Spice and rattling her nerves. He'd traded in his white waiter's tux for an old Red Sox t-shirt and jeans. In daylight, she saw that he had brown hair with hints of red, deep brown eyes with hints of green, a face closer to 40 than 30, weather-beaten and hawkish. Intense, she thought immediately. He took a couple of steps away from her and she noticed a limp. He winced, but covered up by pressing his lips into a thin line.
I take it you're here for work? She said finally.
We're dismantling the juice carts. It's a laugh a minute.
I'm sure it is. Now, is there something in particular that dragged you out into the living room?
Tools. Harry was in charge, and all he brought was a ball peen hammer. Not too bright, Harry,
she said briskly. The toolkit is in the utility closet in the kitchen. Go look there. David merely stuck his hands in his back pockets.
We searched the kitchen area already. No toolkit. Nice collection of light bulbs, though.
Oh, she frowned. Well, my father might have taken it out for something. Go ask him.
Can't. Dr. Stokes left first thing this morning.
What about Maria?
That the maid? I haven't seen her.
Well, maybe my mother knows what my father did with it.
Mrs. Stokes has gone, too. She didn't want to be late for her spa.
Oh, I forgot. Sunday was AA day. Her mother wouldn't be home until at least 5, which meant it really was up to Melanie to find the missing toolkit. She rose to her feet, but David didn't seem to be in the mood to move. In fact, he appeared to have something on his mind. She looked at him curiously. He asked abruptly,
"How are you?"
"Fine."
"Spending the night on the couch?"
"It's a very comfortable sofa."
"With a clear view of Megan's portrait?"
"I came for the sofa, not the view."
"Uh-huh,"
he said.
"Just because a man showed up last night and alleged that the murderer of Megan Stokes was really your father? That your adoptive parents aren't as good or kind as you believe?"
"Oh my God, you heard everything."
She had thought he'd arrived only toward the end. She hadn't realized. He'd never said. She jabbed a finger at his chest.
"How dare you? You stood there and eavesdropped on my life.
What the hell did you think you were doing?
Checking to see if you were all right.
Damn it, why did you follow me last night?
David shook his head, his voice ringing with disdain.
You walked out the door in the middle of your own party with some suspicious man administering a death grip to your arm, and you have to ask why I followed? Christ sakes, you looked like you were setting yourself up to get killed.
I can take care of myself.
Lady, go tell that to my shoes.
Melanie flushed. Shit. She had thrown up on him. It was hard to argue with that. Before she could summon some smart retort anyway, just for pride's sake, he said,
I got a job to do. When you find the tools, yell for Harry.
Fine.
Fine.
He headed down the hall and Melanie thought, good riddance. It was late. She needed to get on with her day. Then a fresh thought struck her and made her call him back.
Wait!
Halfway down the hall, David halted grudgingly, giving her an impatient stare.
Since you did hear everything.
Uh-huh.
What did you think of Larry Digger?
I think he's probably a drunk,
David said matter-of-factly. She breathed easier. Yes, this was the opinion she wanted. Assurances that Larry Digger was full of shit. It's a preposterous story.
Lot of holes, like you said.
Really?
She waved her hand dismissively.
No parents in their right mind would give the child of their daughter's murderer a home. That's outrageous.
David nodded again, but now his gaze was hooded and hard to read.
He's probably just after money, she said. Thank you, Mr. Reese. I'll get those tools to you shortly.
There was one interesting thing he did bring up,
David said. Melanie paled. What?
Why now? If it's all about money, why didn't Larry Digger approach you or your parents years ago?
Melanie suddenly had a chill. She rubbed her arms to chase it away. It could have taken him a long time to come up with the story. Or maybe he didn't need money before.
The phone call's interesting, too. Why say that he'd traced the tip to your house? Why add that particular detail?
Melanie couldn't answer. Would Larry Digger really try to be exact if he simply wanted money? Cons could be elaborate. But why now? Not earlier, when she would have been more vulnerable, more interested in the past. She was still churning the questions over in her mind when David said,
I could help you with this.
Pardon?
I used to be a policeman, all right? I got arthritis. Took me off the force, but I still have contacts. If you want, I could check out Larry Digger.
The limp, the twinges of pain he tried to hide, must be from the arthritis. And his having been a cop would explain why he had followed her last night. Everything about Larry Digger would have triggered his instincts, so he had followed and looked out for her. Melanie found herself warming toward David Reese, but then she shook her head. It's okay, I can take care of it.
With all due respect, what do you know about a man like Larry Digger?
Well, for starters, I know I can check his story about the anonymous tip by looking through our phone bills. David narrowed his eyes.
What about a full background search?
I'll call his employer. Newspapers in Texas.
Know how many newspapers there are in Texas?
Melanie smiled at him sweetly. Then I'd better get right on it, shouldn't I?
Don't give an inch, huh? Don't ever ask for help.
Welcome to the Stokeses, Mr. Reese. We take care of our own.
Yeah?
David gave her a hard stare.
Then why, when some tired old reporter was dragging you out of your own home, was a waiter the only one who noticed? What do you think of that, Miss Stokes?
Melanie didn't have an answer. 2 cups of coffee later, alone in the dining room, Melanie watched the afternoon sun sift through lace curtains as she picked at a blueberry muffin.
Maybe you had to see them in Texas with their 2 kids. One so sweet everyone loved her. And one already so troubled half the moms on the block wouldn't let him play with their children. I'm getting the impression, Ms. Holmes, there's a hell of a lot about your family you just plain don't know.
Why didn't she know more about Megan Stokes or her family's life in Texas? In spite of her bold words to both Larry Digger and David Reese, that fact was beginning to trouble Melanie. She'd always assumed that the subject of Megan was too painful for her parents to discuss. Also, it was probably not a topic of conversation they wanted to share with their adopted daughter. In spite of what people like to say, families with adopted children had different dynamics. The beginning was not natural or smooth, but held a closer analogy to dating. Everyone wore their nicest clothes, practiced their best manners, and tried not to do anything that would make them look too foolish. Then came the honeymoon phase, when parent and child could do no wrong, since everyone was just so gosh darn happy to have one another. Then, if the adoption was successful, the family finally eased into the 50 years of marriage stage. Comfortable, well-adapted, knowing each family member's strengths and weaknesses, and loving them anyway. Melanie liked to think her family had achieved that final stage of familial nirvana, but now she had to wonder. If they were so comfortable with one another, why hadn't they ever spoken of Megan? Why hadn't Melanie asked? Even if it had been painful once. It had been 20 years ago. Surely after 2 decades. It's the past, she told herself firmly. It shouldn't matter. But now she was no longer certain. Larry Digger's insinuations were taking root. The reporter was starting to win. Melanie gave up on the muffin. She crossed the hall into her father's study, where she was immediately greeted by the sight of books piled everywhere. On the cherrywood desk, on the red leather swivel chair, and on the floor. Apparently, while she'd been out dealing with Larry Digger, the literacy ball had turned into quite a success. She should catalog the books that afternoon, prepare them for inventory by the rare book dealer on Boylston Street. There was a lot of work to get done. Melanie opened up the mahogany file cabinet and looked for a file marked 9X. The good news was that her predictably anal father did keep the phone records each month. The bad news was that they had not yet received the new bill covering 3 weeks ago. Tomorrow she would call and request an early copy of the bill. That would take care of Larry Digger. But what about her own past? Why hadn't her parents pressed to find out more? In the beginning, they had probably been scared. If they found her real parents, those parents could potentially take her away from them. But it had been 20 years, and they had never once asked her if she remembered anything. They had never even asked her if she wanted to pursue things further. What about hypnosis or regression therapy or things like that? Surely her father as a doctor had thought about it. But nothing was ever said, and Melanie was left with the uncomfortable thought that for all the closeness in her family, there was a strange, unspoken rule. Don't push too hard. Don't say too much. Don't look back.
I'm getting the impression, Miss Holmes, there's a hell of a lot about your family you just plain don't know.
And if you told them the same, she thought bluntly, what would they say? She was no better. She liked her privacy, too. She'd never told her family the details of what went on with William. She'd never talked about the perfect first date, when he'd taken her walking along the Charles and they had discussed greedily, almost feverishly, what it was like to grow up knowing you'd been abandoned by your birth parents. She'd never talked about the weekend 3 months later, the perfect weekend when they had made love until 4 in the morning, later getting dressed, her body all languid and flushed from sex. Melanie had spotted the lace bra stuffed beneath the mattress, the bra that wasn't her own. She'd gone home knowing her engagement would have to end, but never mentioning a word of it to her parents. When the deed was finally done, she'd simply told them it hadn't worked out. No more, no less. Her parents seemed to understand, though she could tell her father was hurt. William had been his idea, after all. No one spoke of it again, and Melanie liked it that way. She had her past, her parents had their past. The more she thought of it, the less she found it sinister, and the more she considered it basic human nature. Little secrets, little moments of privacy. That was all. Just because people needed their space didn't mean they'd conspired to adopt the daughter of a killer. That was absurd. Larry Digger was absurd. Tomorrow she'd get the phone bill. It would reveal no calls to Texas. Then they could all get on with their lives. And the voids? The little girl's voice and cries to go home? Melanie didn't have an easy answer for that one. She was 29 years old. She liked her work, enjoyed her community, loved her family. Did she really care about where she came from anymore? Was there ever a point in your life when you didn't? Melanie sighed. She wasn't going to get much done in her current state of mind. What she needed was a good jog. She went upstairs, her footsteps slowing as she saw her bedroom door. It was ajar. She could see the reflection of tiny flickering lights on the wood panel. Then the smell hit her. Gardenias, thick and cloying. Melanie didn't own anything that smelled like gardenias. Something was beginning to stir again. Shadows shifting in her mind, ripples in the void. She pushed open her door. Her bed came into view. She'd left it rumpled in the middle of the night. Now the yellow sheets were drawn up, the handmade blue and purple quilt perfectly smooth. Melanie's bed was never made. Maria? She whispered. No answer. Her gaze fell to the foot of her bed, and all of a sudden the images exploded. Little girl holding the red wooden pony, little girl on the floor of the crude wood cabin, clutching her favorite toy to her chest.
I want to go home,
she whimpered. Give me the toy, sweetheart. If you give me the toy.
I want to go home.
Megan stopped pouting.
Please.
Give me the pony.
I want to go home. I want to go home. I want to go home. No, 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 no.
Melanie ran into the hall. She was crying, falling to her knees, pressing her forehead against the floor, trying to get the images to go away. She didn't want to know. She didn't want to see. Then she inhaled the scent of gardenias again, and the pictures resumed rolling. Vaguely, she heard footsteps pounding up the stairs.
Hello? I thought I heard a cry. Melanie!
She couldn't get her head up. She couldn't tell David Reese to stay away. It wasn't his business, no one's business but hers. She lay there with her head pressed against the floor, and distorted pictures flashed like light bulbs in her mind. Megan, pony, cabin, Megan, pony, cabin. Who is in the doorway? Who is standing in the doorway? What am I doing here? I don't want to know. I don't want to know.
Oh, God,
David said. Melanie looked up. He was staring into a room with an expression on his face she couldn't read. Maybe it was shock. Maybe it was pity. She had to turn away, and then she whispered,
Don't let my parents see. My brother will know what to do.
She closed her eyes again. Who is in the doorway? Who is standing in the doorway?
I don't want to know.
7. Brian Stokes had always known he was destined for a difficult life. From earliest memory, his moods had been cynical and bleak. His childhood was defined by endless gray nights, his father always working at the hospital while his mother sat stiffly on the sofa, regal in her loneliness. Sometimes Brian would play little games, cuddling up to his mother, giving her his most charming grin until she would finally smile and pull him into her sweet-smelling embrace. Other nights he was cruel, smashing vases and furniture, running screaming through the house until his mother would break down into tears, sobbing and crying and begging to know why he hated her so much. At the age of 6, he didn't have an answer. He didn't know why he made his mother laugh or why he made his mother cry. He was mostly aware of a sense of guilt and insecurity, that something in the household just wasn't right. They would all hate him in the end, he thought. His father, his mother, his baby sister Megan. Probably the only person he'd been good to in his life was Melanie. And lately he'd been mean even to her. He'd ignored her phone calls and other overtures. He'd removed himself to his South Boston condo, where he could hone his self-loathing to a razor-sharp edge. 3 months ago, he'd lain in bed, wondering why he didn't just slit his wrists. Then had thought of Megan. Precious, beautiful Megan. The way she used to hold out her arms and beg for piggybacks. The nights he used to run to her room just to watch her sleep, to keep her safe, though he hadn't known from what. Not until it was too late.
Megan, I am so sorry.
He'd gotten out a box of razors. And then he'd thought of Melanie. The way she'd looked the first time he'd seen her. The way she'd thrown her arms around him. The way she had loved him. Simply loved him. Melanie had brought life back into the Stokes family, and Brian could not fail her. If he didn't want to live for himself, then he would have to live for her. He joined a support group. He was learning that he carried too much rage. He was learning that he had conflicted views of his family and issues with real intimacy. He was learning he needed to figure out once and for all who he wanted to be. Not what his father wanted, not what his family wanted, but what he wanted. Brian Stokes needed to learn to love himself. And he was realizing more and more that had less to do with his confusion about being a homosexual and more to do with his guilt over his baby sister's death. 25 years later, all those days in Texas were suddenly haunting him with a vengeance. Some nights he'd wake up in a cold sweat. Other times he'd wake up screaming. Then there was the night Brian dreamed his own parents' death. And it made him happy. These days he did not trust himself to go home. Then this morning, Jamie O'Donnell had called. Melanie was looking too pale, too worn around the edges, Jamie said flatly. She'd had a migraine last night, and she had migraines only under extreme stress. Did Brian know what the hell was going on? He didn't. He was concerned. Then he got the call after 2 p.m. Some man who wouldn't give his name, curtly stating that Melanie needed him. Brian didn't argue. He ignored his father's specific declaration that Brian Stokes was no longer welcome at Beacon Street, and ran through 2 red lights in his haste to get there. He still wasn't prepared for the scene in Melanie's room. He took one look at the old red wooden pony and the altar of lit votive candles and said,
"Don't let Mom see that."
"Are you kidding? For God's sake, get in here and shut the door."
Brian entered the bedroom and shut the door. His sister stood across the room, still wearing pajamas, though it was extremely late in the day. Her arms were wrapped around her waist. Tears stained her cheeks. The sight of her so obviously frightened undid him. Melanie was never frightened. Never.
"Melanie?"
He took an automatic step toward her, then hesitated. She looked unsure of him, conscious of the gulf that had grown between them. That was fair, he decided. He was standing in this room, and he was unsure. Another awkward moment passed. She finally broke the silence.
"Brian, meet David Reese."
She pointed to the only other person in the room, who was moving around with purpose.
"David Reese is a former police officer," she explained. "He has contacts."
"Former police officer?" "Arthritis,"
David said curtly. Brian nodded. He'd noticed the limp.
"I called in a friend, an active detective, someone who knows how to be discreet. Your sister is real hung up on being discreet."
Melanie was looking at Brian questioningly. He finally nodded his approval. He didn't know what he thought of David Reese, but he didn't know what else to do. He'd never seen anything like this before, and he didn't have any connections in law enforcement.
"Jesus Christ, what is this?"
Brian finally burst out.
"I mean, who would? How? Why?" "Don't know yet,"
the ex-cop said.
"We'll start with the what, which is 44 votive candles scented with gardenias. One red wooden pony, a scrap of old blue fabric, some bloodstains. Note the arrangement of the candles. Someone's sending a message."
Brian turned slightly and gazed at the arrangement straight on. Shit. The flickering candles spelled one word. Megan. A distant memory returned to Brian. Baby Megan on the floor, Brian grabbing her doll and ripping it apart. Megan crying, not understanding. Brian shaking the stuffing all over the floor. "You gotta be tough, Megan. You gotta be tough." The distance between them yawned again.
"I got up in the middle of the night," Melanie said quietly. "I went downstairs. When I came back up, well, here it was."
"You were up in the middle of the night?"
Brian asked sharply.
"Melanie, it's been years."
"Do you sleepwalk?"
David Reese asked her. But Melanie was gazing at Brian, and in her eyes he saw what he'd been most afraid of. Hurt. He'd hurt her. When Melanie got up in the middle of the night, Brian was supposed to be there for her. He was the one who always woke up, always followed her downstairs to keep guard as she stared at Megan's portrait. He was her older brother. It was his job. I don't sleepwalk, she said after a while. Sometimes I'm just restless. Melanie. Later, Brian. Much later. David Reese cleared his throat, forcing their attention back to him.
Your mother could return home at any time, so we gotta get working here.
Without waiting for an answer, he continued brusquely.
Let's start with the horse. It's the one from the oil portrait downstairs, isn't it? Megan's horse?
The chipped ear,
Brian murmured.
I did that. I threw it against the